of San Diego, and we just got started on the thing, and he and I and Roberta Ridgely, and Roberta and I had both been at the Globe Theater, and Ed and Roberta wanted me to start doing this.
Okay, let's take it from the top now, because we are recording. There's no particular beginning, and we can edit as we need to, so we can say scratch that if you don't. This is just raw material, so to speak. This is August the 20th.
August, we're in September.
I've been outside too long today.
12th.
September 12th, 1979. And Merle Clayton is being interviewed by Charles Brockman in East San Diego at his home. His experience will speak for itself. I'll just ask the question you'd ask anybody you didn't really know too well. Where were your beginnings and why are you here if they weren't here?
Well, I came to San Diego in 1938 from the East. I had been a professional actor. I had written in 1935 and 36 a column for Midwest newspapers, Hot on the Lot. And then in the 60s, I met itself, the San Diego Magazine, and Roberta Ridgely and I had been in the Globe Theater together, been in a number of plays.
May I interpose a question here? Where exactly in the East were you from? Were you born?
Kansas City, Missouri.
And that's sort of in the middle of Missouri, isn't it?
No, it's right over on. Kansas City's right on the state line of
Kansas,
Missouri.
Oh, I have a brother there. I misunderstood you. Mm-hmm. I have a brother who's a minister there. And he says it gets hot as blazes.
Oh, he's right. I won't use that word.
And the snow comes in the winter, and he said, "You lucky bastard."
I grew up in Kansas City.
Well, I noticed you ended up here, and I hope you will too sometime, because this is a much more pleasant place to be.
Well, there'd be a long story to why I went back to Kansas City after I said I'd never go back again, and that's when I was writing a book, so I won't tell that on here.
Well,
that
wherever you were born, you have ties that you want to go back and reckon with, I guess.
Well, I said I would never go back. It was hot. It was dirty. And I had to go east on a book I was writing, Union Station Massacre, on an event that had happened in my hometown of Kansas City in 1933 in front of the Union Station there, when five officers, including a FBI man, was shot and killed there at 7:15 in the morning. And I was a 1933, June the 11th.
Was that Dillinger?
No. Dillinger had nothing to do with this. The FBI was returning an escaped convict to the federal penitentiary up at Leavenworth, Kansas, there. And the FBI was returning him. The Kansas City police were supposed to lend help to him. At 7:15 in the morning, they were bringing him out of the station across a car to drive up to Leavenworth, followed by a Kansas City detectives on the thing. Pretty Boy Floyd and an opinion, and a gangster by the name of Vern Miller, who is a paid killer from the Purple Gang in Chicago and Detroit, and was also a paid killer, just a paid killer for Al Capone. And they attempted to free this Frank Jelly Nash. And the fire broke out. Two Kansas City policemen were killed. A chief of police from McAllister, Oklahoma, was killed. An FBI man was shot and killed. And this happened that morning. About 15 minutes afterwards, I was on the spot. I was just a young kid. My father worked on the Kansas City Journal-Post and got a call that morning to get to the paper immediately. And I just went with my father down to the paper, which was near the Union Station, to see what had gone wrong. And I walked across.
What time of day was it?
Pardon?
What time of day was it?
7:15 in the morning. I was there about 7:30, 7:20.
And you saw the immediate results?
Well, I saw the bodies. They hadn't removed the bodies, things. And the car, the riddled car, see, when Pretty Boy Floyd and Vern Miller opened these machine guns, they was coming crisscross, and the car looked like a piece of Swiss cheese. It was just filled with bullet holes because these old Thompson machine guns, once you start them, they're on a cylinder and you can't stop the things. There was 500 bullets that went there in about 3/4 of a minute.
Did you see Bonnie and Clyde?
Yes, and I thought it was awful. It
well,
was a bunch of crap.
Scene was the thing
but
in it?
I talked to F. Joe Lackey, who was one of the FBI men in the car, and had two of the bullets in the base of his spine on the thing. I talked to him in his home in when I was writing this book in Houston, Texas, and he gave me the whole results of how it felt that morning. The whole thing happened in 3/4 of a minute, and these bullets going.
Do you have a copy of that book here?
Sure. Sure.
Later on, we'll borrow it if you let me, okay?
Yeah.
I'll take it with me and look at it if I could.
I'll give you a copy of it.
I'd love to read it.
All right.
Ben, you were what age when you first arrived in San Diego?
Oh, I come here in 1938. So I was about 23 years old when I came.
We're the same age.
Yeah.
You sure are. When's your birthday?
September the 17th, next week.
Next week you're going to be 57?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be 57 next April. It's illegal to go 55.
All right. I think we'll make it. But, no, I had aspiring, and I thought I was going to be the greatest actor in the world in 1935. I am a very well-known screenwriter and motion picture producer, John Paxton. We grew up together in Kansas City, and we come out to Hollywood in 1935.
Tell me something. Have you read, what's the name of the author from there who's very popular from Kansas City, or from St. Louis? Let me see. Wait a minute. He wrote Slaughterhouse-Five.
No, I haven't. I have to admit.
Have you read his books?
No, I haven't. I'll
the only reason I asked that was it connected with something you were saying right immediately. Do you remember what brought on your first ambition to be connected with the stage? What aspect?
Oh, I don't know. It was during the Depression, and I was going to school, and I got work in the Lowe's Midland Theater, a motion picture house, one of the big cathedrals in downtown Kansas City.
Uh-huh.
And I guess one thing and another, and then I got involved in little theaters, and one thing, just as I said, led to another.
What are some of your early, you know, whenever I've been in several places, so amateur mm-hmm. places, of course, and I directed one, which was T.S. Eliot's Cocktail Party,
mm-hmm.
which I dearly love as a piece of literature also.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fairly acquainted with Shakespeare from the Park, Shakespeare in the Park,
yeah.
New York City, and other things. And, of course, Laurence Olivier's movie, especially.
Sure.
So I feel at home there, but I've never spent as much time as I'd like to. When you got here, was the Globe Theater already working? Or?
Yes, the Globe Theater was in existence at that time.
Tell us what you remember about your early association with that.
Well, At that time, of course, it was in the old theater, it was before the fire on the thing, and I had appeared in a road company of a Broadway hit called Three Men on a Horse, and I read for the part that I played across the United States, and naturally, I could still could get in the Globe. I wasn't that bad an actor in the thing, and I just went from there into others, and I stayed with the Globe through the years.
Was Three Men on a Horse the title of a Marx Brothers movie or
not? No, it never was. They'd made it into a movie, but the Marx Brothers
Marx Brothers.
No.
Somehow that sounds
But
like
Three Men on a Horse was a big Broadway hit, I believe, in 1936, and then later they made
was
a movie.
Was it a musical altogether?
No, it was a straight play.
Oh, well, I just didn't know what it was. Do you remember the author of it?
No, I'd have to go to my books here and see. I don't remember.
We can look it up. But
yeah, it's here.
But what were the first things you acted in when you were here in the Globe? What were your first part?
Well, the first thing I did was Three Men on a Horse. Then I was in Shaw's, one of Bernard Shaw's plays that I did there. And
which
then
one was
I,
it? Do you remember? Was it Joan of Arc?
No.
Faust and the Devil?
No, it wasn't any one of those. Faye Emerson was in the cast, who later went on to the movies there. She was in the cast of the thing that's directed.
Was it the thing they made a movie of? Pygmalion?
No, I can't. Well, when we get through here, I'll look it up in these plays. I should know the name of it. And then later, I was played rabbi in Abe's Irish Rose.
That was the greatest hit of the whole season, wasn't it?
Well, at the time, it was some many years before, and it had been originally put on Broadway back in the 20s by a very, very well-known Broadway producer, Al Woods, who I later worked for Woods, and Woods thought the world knew me because he thought I was one of the funniest people he'd ever seen in his life. Well, that showed he wasn't very good.
How would you classify Abe's Irish Rose as social satire or comedy? Or
all satire of the times. It was a typical
good
thing. And there was nothing that actually hurt anyone. It was a feud between the Jewish family and the Irish family, the Jewish boy that wanted to marry the Irish girl, you know. And nothing was hurtful
in
anything.
It's sort of like All in the Family and things like that.
Yeah, it was one of those type of things. It was very, very successful. But it was... at the time I did it, it was an old play. It's an old turkey there.
Right. Well, what was the first Shakespeare you acted in, though?
The first Shakespeare that I acted in was Merry Wives of Windsor. No. Yes, I did Merry Wives of Windsor, and then I did Taming of the Shrew, again with Faye Emerson, and a well-known Hollywood San Diego businessman in advertising, Jim Holloway. There's a whole bunch of us, and it was directed by Luther King. But later, I did Shakespeare for B. Iden Payne when he came here. I did parts for him in that, because I did want to have the honor of even a small part in working under B. Iden Payne. I didn't think I was qualified for it, but he said to me, he said, you let me be the judge of that,
right.
And I ended up working for him.
Well, most of your career has been devoted to writing, though, has it not?
I was interested in writing back, as I said, in 1936, because I came back to Hollywood in 36 to try and get in pictures, and I was writing a column, a Hot on the Lot, which was a Hollywood column-like thing, for a group of Midwest newspapers. Well, in August of that year, I run into the woman that had written a play, Arrest That Woman, in Hollywood the year before. Woods saw me and offered me a contract on the thing. Well, they never got it off of the ground. And then I run into her, as I said, in August of 36. Woods was going to produce it that fall with Doris Nolan. And I had worked with Doris. We had both worked for Woods in a big successful play the night of January the 16th before. Well, the newspaper thing fell right that afternoon. The box for putting with the makeup come right out again, and 3 days later I was on the Santa Fe Chief going to Chicago, on to New York to work again for Woods.
Did you enjoy your trip across the country?
Oh, I've been across the country so many times, I'm like an eagle.
Trip, was that your first trip?
Oh, no. Yes, I come out here, as I said, in 1935.
Well, you're lucky. I mean, in a way, because I never saw anything west of Memphis, Tennessee, until I drove out here in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I'd been to Europe and the war and all that stuff, but did we hear the service?
No, they turned me down because when I went up to try out for the Army, I couldn't test the scales at 100 pounds. I weighed 98, and he said, for God's sakes, we have to put down 100. And he took a look, and I couldn't see across the room. And he said, we don't need you that bad yet.
I wish I had that problem right now, being too thin, I'll tell you.
But anyway, they wouldn't take me, and I went back to work here in San Diego for Marston's. I went to work for Marston's.
And what
when
did
I first
you do
came.
At Marston's? What was your first job there?
Well, I only had one job in the time I was there. I was assistant manager for the toy and luggage department. I never worked in any other department.
Well, you met all the interesting people in town at Christmas time, didn't you?
Oh, sure. I'm still remembered by their children and grandchildren.
Right, yeah.
I remember you, Mr. Clayton, when you had the electric trains down at Marston's. Well, it's a lot of fun.
I think I'd love a job like that. That's a hell of a lot cooler than the Santa Claus, isn't it?
Oh, sure. But as I said, I stayed on with Marston's. And I stayed because they had given me a job when I come here in 1938, and times were still very hard. And I felt an obligation to go back to with them, although San Diego Office Supply had tried to lure me away. And I told them I would go back and talk to them after the war was over, that I wasn't leaving Marston's while the war was on.
Tell me something about Marston's. It's changed now. It's called
the Broadway.
Broadway. Are there any of the original family connected with it still?
No longer, no.
They have a place at the corner of Balboa Park, I believe, do they not?
Yes, Hamilton Marston, the grandson of George Marston, lives in the old home that his father, Arthur Marston, lived in.
When you were working at Marston's, how many branches of the store were there?
None.
When did they first branch out?
I believe that was in about 1963 when they opened that Grossmont store. I was not working for them at that time, so I'm just guessing at the date, so please don't quote
me. Their headquarters is now in Mission Valley, I believe.
Well, their headquarters is in Los Angeles, California.
In other words, it's no longer a family.
No, Marstons have nothing, absolutely nothing to do with it any longer.
Since you were in this particular field, do you know anything much about Scott?
No. I knew he had this store, the Walker Scott store, but I never met George Scott in my life. I don't know the man.
What year? Do you remember what year it was that you left Marstons?
Yes, I left Marstons in September 1945. And in January of 46, I come up to North Park to manage a store for San Diego Office Supply. I went with San Diego Office Supply in September of that year and come up here, and I stayed with them for 10 years.
They're a good store. They've got branches all
over. Oh, they've got branches all over, and yes. The only reason I left San Diego Office Supply, I saw the trend that merchandising was going into day and night and all of this sort of thing. I had a son growing up. I had a wonderful wife, and I wanted to spend some time with them, and I wanted to be a writer, and that's when I said, to heck with it, I'll starve to death with the rest of them and become a writer.
Tell me something, since it's obvious you didn't starve to death by a long shot, what did you feel like when you first made a sale of something you'd written?
Well, the first thing that I ever sold was to Mutual Broadcasting. For several years there, I did television dramas, our ones.
What were the ones you did?
Well, they were my own original, they were one-hour dramas for radio.
Right. Okay, what was the name of the series, though?
Well, it was just Mutual of On the Air.
Mutual of Omaha?
No, the Mutual Broadcasting.
All right, come in. Let me, hang in a second. Let me cut it off.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. See, let me tell you what was said over briefly. He came from the East when he was very young, and came here and he worked in the theater Globe Theater.
Yeah. Globe, which is a non-profit.
He began his career downtown at Marston's, where he had charge of the toys and the train.
As assistant, assistant manager.
Him, don't say it, cause something else, you know. And he was like a little bit like Gresham May in that he knew three generations of people who traded at Marston's, I reckon.
Oh, sure, I still run into grandchildren. Oh, Mr. Clayton, I remember you. You had some electric trains down at my... But it's wonderful. I get a great kick out of it.
Well, sure.
This fleet, Sandy Fleet, the old consolidated aircraft here, he ran to me one day, and he said, "You don't remember me, do you?" And I looked, and I said, "No, I don't." He said, "I'm Sandy Fleet." I said, "Oh, my gosh almighty." And we got to talking. He said, "I never forgot you, Mr. Clayton. You let me come behind the counter and play with the trains." And the same way with Tommy Sefton down here. But Tommy's a little older than that. I used to let him come in and play with
you. Sit over there, because I've been asking the questions, and you can just carry on where we are. And not getting the show on the road. And I think it's best for him just to speak.
Tom Sefton is a banker, excuse me, Charles. Mm-hmm. That is very much involved in collecting train sets.
Yeah.
And they run usually a two or three page feature about once a year on Tom Sefton's train collection, because he has a whole attic that has nothing but trains in it.
Yeah, he has quite a collection.
And I would say that Tom Sefton is probably in his 60s,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't you?
Pardon?
He's probably
60. Well, I was saying about getting close to it. Yes,
When he said, you know, he wasn't
a kid. I'm going to tell you something. Yeah. The mic will pick you up right there where you are. If you're talking as you would to me, in other words, it'll pick you up fine.
Okay, well, let me try and... You
but
know,
talk to him, but blow the voice like... Okay.
I just want to tell you, about Tom Sefton. Now, a lot of these people, this is where Barry Yannis, going back to Frank the Train Man, comes in. Mm-hmm. This is where they all go.
We're recording.
Well, I knew Frank the Train Man before he ever got in that business.
Did you know Frank the Train Man?
Oh, yeah, I knew him before he ever started on this thing. He was hanging around Marston's down there in the electric trains. No kidding. Sure. And then he started out repairing trains, and he wasn't selling anything. He started collecting them, and he just drew into a nice little business out of which was very wonderful.
When did he begin his job? Do you remember?
Pardon?
When did Frank the Train Man start out?
Oh, I think that he started in business in the 50s. That would be my estimate, because when I first knew him was between 1940 and 1945 when I left Marston's. And
was Marston's asking him for advice on what to buy?
No, no. He just come in there because we had this really nice display of trains that nobody else in San Diego had, you know. And he hung around there, you know. And
Left Marston's, what did you do then?
Well, as I said, I come out to North Park for San Diego Office Supply to manage a store
That's
out there.
That's the part I forgot. He got a job with the biggest outfitter in the whole area.
Well, they had wanted me to go to work for them before the war ended, as I told him, and I'm talking in here again, I said I wouldn't leave Marston's during the war. The Army rejected me because of my weight and my eyesight on the thing. And I said, no, that Marston's had been very nice to me, that they'd give me a job in 1938 when there were things were hard here when I first came to San Diego, and I'd go right back there and stay. But at the end of the war, that I wanted to leave Marston's because I didn't feel that there was an opportunity for advancement there. That was no reflection. They're a fine family, but it is a family thing. And my boss, Mr. Larry Weiner, who was sick most of the time, and I ran the department most of the time, but he said, well, I don't blame you, Merle. He said, I hate to see you go, but he said, I think this thing. So when the war ended, I went over to talk to Les Sturgeon, who is the retired president of the San Diego office, flying the chairman of the thing. Now his son is running the thing. And he said, well, I wondered if you'd come in to see me, Merle. And I said, yep, I want to talk to you. So he hired me to, on the condition that I'd go out to North Park and manage the store. I didn't know, I knew a pencil, but not for a pencil sharpener from a ledger. And I spent 3 months downtown getting acquainted with office supplies and what file folders were used for what things, you know. And then I went out there and I stayed with him for 10 years. And at the end of that time, I felt what I thought merchandise was going into a whole new train of things where you'd be there day and night. I had a son growing up. I hardly knew as the store, and I wanted some time with my wife. As I told him, I decided, well, in 1936, when I came back to Hollywood, I'd come out here in 35 into Hollywood, and I was writing a column hot off the lot, which was a Hollywood column for Midwest newspapers there. And then in August of that time, I had an opportunity to go back to New York to work for Al Woods. I'd worked for Woods before, and the column just dropped, period, and the grease paint took over. I had that much of a ham, I couldn't resist the chance of going back to New York. And 3 days later, I was on the Chief, headed for New York City, and worked for Al Woods again. And then I went back, and then the play that went back to do for Woods, Arrest That Woman, after 2 months it folded. It wasn't a very good play. And I came back to Kansas City to see my folks, and then decided to come back to California. And when I got back out here, Woods was here, and I wasn't making much headway. And then my father passed away, and I thought that I owed it to my mother to come here and help her. I had one younger brother, and my sister lived here then. She'd come with my mother and my mother's twin sister. So I came down to here. And then in 56, I decided I was going to try writing again, and I began, I had some success of doing radio dramas, hour dramas, and did those for the Mutual Broadcasting radio system there. And then I did one season of gratis for the Globe Theater on the air. That was something that they didn't have to pay for there. And it really gave them an opportunity to do something, and they were giving them the time on the thing, so I did that for them. And one thing just led to another. And then I had, in managing the San Diego office supply, I had met a Mrs. Brennan, who was a descendant of the Bandini family here. And I had arranged for her to try and get a book published that she wanted published. Well, they weren't about to buy the thing. I thought the material was great, and tried to arrange for someone else to take it over and write a book on the Bandini family. Well, Roberta Ridgely and I had been together at the Globe Theater, and Roberta then was the assistant editor for the San Diego Magazine. And Roberta came to me one day and said, Merle, wouldn't you do a story on the Bandinis for the magazine? And I don't know, I kind of, and drug on, and she had asked me again, and finally she said, well, Merle, don't you want to do it? And I had told her, I said, oh, I thought someone should do it because I thought this material was really terrific. Was one, and the way I guess I sounded like, well, I'm too good to worth sending. I said, well, yes. She said, well, will you come in and talk to Ed? And Ed Self, the editor of the magazine. And I said, sure. So I went in, met with her and Ed, and we sat down, talked about 10 minutes, and that was it. I did it. Three long articles, but I decided I was going to do it. I was going to do it right. I love to do research. And I wrote what I thought was a very good thing, because I did research and went clear back to the Vatican Library in Rome and went clear back to the original story of the Bandinis, who were not as many people thought of, were Spanish. They weren't originally. They were Italians. They come from Florence, Italy in 1011. We're related to the Medicis, and I followed the whole damn thing around through Spain, and the branch had broke off. Well, anyway, that was how. And then I went on to do those things, and as I told him of an event that had happened in Kansas City when I was just a young punk of a kid, the Union Station Massacre, that had a big shootout in front of the Union Station in 1935. And John Paxton, who I came to California with in 1935 to be an actor, and John went back to New York with me, and John had gone to the University of Missouri and graduated as a journalist. And during the Depression, he couldn't get on a newspaper anyplace. And then he finally got on with Stage Magazine in New York and went on to be one of Hollywood's really top writers and producers of the movie Koch. And our friendship was just like a brother. We were just very, very close to each other. And we'd always reminisce of kids when we were in Kansas, you know. And finally, we had talked about this Union Station massacre, but I was always just talking about it and talking about it, you know. And finally, one evening, I was up with John and his wife, Sarah Jane, and we went out to get some bread for dinner. And John looked at me and he said, "Merle," he said, "if you don't sit down and write that Union Station massacre," said, "don't you ever come up here again." Well, I know you didn't mean it. But I got thinking about it, so I went home and I sat down and I wrote it, a little 10-page thing, as I remembered the whole doggone thing. And I took it back up and I said to John, I said, "All right, you threw it down. What do you think?" So he said, "Well, let me take a nap." He did, and he said, "I think it's good, Merle, that you'll have to have a story to pay Hagen." I said, "I know that." I said, "But you want to see something." I said, and gave it to an agent, and he really just read me up one side and down the other, because he was mad at me because I wouldn't do a book that he wanted me to do on the old luxury trains of the United States. And so the way he threw it to me, I got so mad that I thought, well, I know I can write. God damn it, I had an acquaintance by telephone who I did some work for with Bob Smirrow, and he was editor-in-chief, Bob Amundsen. And I just sent this thing to him. It had never been gone over or punctuated or anything. It was just on yellow sheets. It was 15 pages, I think, of this Union Station massacre thing. And I said, "Bob, I want your opinion. Do you think there's a possibility for a book in this thing?" And I waited and waited, and I didn't get any answer from him. And he was always very, very good about answering any letters I ever wrote him. And then one day I get a letter from Walter Myers, Bob's Merle, that Mr. Amundsen was no longer with him, that he had read this material, and he was interested in seeing a book. Well, I wrote back and said, "Well, I didn't mind other people opening my mail, but I said, I don't think that I could discuss it with you because you have no idea of what I am attempting to do on the thing." And he wrote back and he said, "Well," he said, "Mr. Clayton," he said, "I am interested in crime. I'm a crime buff." He said, "Would you send me kind of a little outline?" So I did. I sent him a little outline. He said, "I'd like to see some more." And then I turned it over to my agent, and the agent said, "Well," he said, "all right, Mr. Clayton, we'll do 3 chapters and a complete outline on it, but at the end of that, you will have to come up with a decision. Do you want the book or not, with the contract and an advance on it?" Well, they just grabbed the thing like that. They didn't have a chance to try other publishers on the thing at all. And I had a contract and a very nice advance on the thing there on it. And that's how I wrote Union Station Massacre on the thing. It was a story. It was a very successful book. I mean, I've always been interested in, and that's why the thing was with itself on the Bandini thing. And Roberta wanted me to do something else for the magazine, and Roberta and I had worked together at the Globe Theater. Of course, I'd been in the theater. And so Ed wanted to do a thing on the history of the theaters in San Diego, the old legitimate theaters on the thing. And he said, "You just give me free hand." He said, "Will you do it for us, Merle?" And I love to work for them. I loved the atmosphere of the place. They left me alone. I could work at home, do as I wanted. They paid nicely for the thing. What more could you ask for? And so I started out to do it, and I did about 15 segments of the thing, starting with the first actual legitimate theater that San Diego ever had in 1884. That was the very first one. It was called the Leech Opera House. Well, it was called the Coliseum. It was in 1884 in June when it opened, built by an Easterner who was a criminal lawyer by the name of Wallace Leech. And 4 months later, he changed the name to the Leech Opera House. Well, that was then the first actual theater that San Diego ever had. Now, they had a place where minstrels and things like that were given down at the old Horton Hall. And that was down on the lower part of 6th Avenue there. Now, I don't know when Horton Hall started, because I just started the thing with the Leech Opera House there.